I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. They are co-authors of the book Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. They will both be here in Santa Fe tomorrow night and will be giving a lecture titled Zubiquity, What Dolphin Diabetes Can Teach Us About Human Health. It's at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So this is a wonderful book. Not only is it interesting, it's beautifully written. And it begins with a surprising revelation, namely that animals get diseases like breast cancer, stress-induced heart attacks, chlamydia, and even psychiatric disorders like depression and self-mutilation. And some animals like to use hallucinogens. We could talk about some of these things. How did you begin studying this?
Yeah, this is Barbara. Well, I'm a cardiologist at UCLA. I've taken care of human patients with heart attacks and high cholesterol for many years. And I had this wonderful opportunity several years ago to become a medical, to join the medical advisory board of our local zoo here in Los Angeles. And it was there that, for the first time, I heard veterinarians on rounds talking about taking care of, you know, congestive heart failure in a gorilla or breast cancer in a lion, or obsessive-compulsive disorder in a bear. And that was literally the first time that I had really thought and even had become aware of the fact that veterinarians are taking care of the same kinds of problems in their animal patients that we physicians take care of in human patients. And that became sort of the jumping-off point to explore what might happen if physicians began thinking about the human patient as a human-animal patient and turning to veterinarians and animal experts for their expertise and wisdom.
It's interesting because, I mean, many of us have had the experience that doctors who are specialists don't talk to other doctors who are specialists, and maybe their specialties would benefit, you know, if they knew each other. And in the same way, doctors and veterinarians have historically, well, have recently had little communication. Has that always been the case historically?
Now, in the past, I mean, hundreds of years ago, and depending, of course, where you're talking about, the same practitioners who would take care of human beings might also take care of animals, particularly if, you know, on a farm situation. But over the last 100 years or so, changes in, you know, the structure of cities in the United States and elsewhere made it such that veterinary schools were placed in more rural areas and most medical schools were in urban areas. And so the two fields began growing apart. And even though the biology that medical students and veterinary students are taught is very similar, the pathology is very similar, the two professions have really gone along without enough intersection.
Tell us that story about the veterinarian who basically was the force behind the discovery of West Nile virus.
This is Catherine. Yes, that veterinarian is one of the vet heroes that we profile in our book, and her name is Tracy McNamara. She's a professor at Western University at the moment, and she was, at the time, the pathologist at the Bronx Zoo. She was a veterinarian and a pathologist there, and what she noticed was that there were a bunch of exotic birds under her care at the zoo who were getting ill, and some of them were passing away. At the same time, she had noticed and heard about crows in Queens, New York, falling out of the sky, hobbling around, also getting really sick and dying. And she knew that there was something up here. She knew that diseases like this aren't usually localized to one area. So she started looking into it and investigating what was killing the birds. At the same time, there were patients, human patients, in areas of New York who were showing up in emergency rooms with high fevers and sort of brain issues that were indicating that it might be something spread by mosquitoes. And what Tracy McNamara did was she put all of these pieces together and figured that the same virus or pathogen might be affecting the birds that was affecting the people. She took her information to the CDC, who had identified it as a different kind of illness called St. Louis encephalitis. And they basically told her, you know, we've solved it. We don't need your information. You're a veterinarian. We work with people. basically, thank you very much, but go away. And she just kept looking and looking and looking. And what she helped discover was that this was actually West Nile virus, and it was making its debut in North America. And in the 10 years since she discovered it, it's spread across the entire continent.
And that actually caused a change in the CDC. They basically had to eat crow.
Oh, that's a good one. I've never thought of that before. they actually did. There was a report that came out after that, and they did start saying that they need to pay more attention to doctors on the veterinary side, and that the two sides should really work more closely together. Whether that's actually happened is up for some debate. I think some vets would say yes, it has, and others would say much more needs to happen.
So both domestic and wild animals get cancer, and many of the same kinds of cancer that we get, breast cancer, prostate cancer, all kinds of things, leukemia, with the same disease trajectories and the same kinds of metastases. How does animal cancer shed light on questions about, for example, whether cancer is caused by our modern way of life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when we began exploring the overlap between the key diseases in human beings and animals, we discovered, just as you said, that both dogs and cats and exotic animals too, for example, get breast cancer. So we learned that pretty much every mammal in which it's been looked for, breast cancer has been found. So we're talking about kangaroos and beluga whales, but it turns out there are certain mammals that seem to get breast cancer more than others. And one group are the felids, the big cats. So these are lions and tigers and actually jaguars as well. In learning why some of these animals may have more breast cancer than others, we learned something about human breast cancer, because it turns out the BRCA1 mutation, which is responsible for breast cancer in some women, also is responsible for breast cancer in some animals. Certain dog breeds, for example, that have a higher rate of breast cancer have it on the basis of this BRCA1 mutation. And the big cats, specifically jaguars, may have their elevated rates of breast cancer, again, due to BRCA1 mutation.
And one thing that I think was really fascinating and also important that we uncovered is the idea of dinosaur cancer. Barbara and I were doing some research in the UCLA Biomedical Library one day and came across a paper that said it was called The Epidemiology of Dinosaur Cancer, and that was just really mind-opening to the idea that, of course, we humans can do things that dial up our risk, that amplify our risks of certain kinds of cancers, but cancer is not something that we humans cause necessarily, and it's as old as the dinosaurs, and we share it with other animals back in time and also with the contemporary animals around us right now.
And some of it is caused, actually a significant amount is caused by viruses.
Yeah, there's a significant amount of cancer that happens in human patients that we know connects to viral infection or exposure to certain viruses, and the same thing is true in animal populations as well. It was interesting talking to veterinarians about animal cancer. There is, they have a different perspective when they look at diseases of animals than the way I think typical physicians do. We typically look at individuals, and veterinarians, I think, tend to look at more the ecology of the situation, at the environment of the animal and groups of animals. And so, when there's an infectious cause for a disease, I think there's a greater willingness and to acknowledge that.
At the same time, animals are also very much affected, and we can talk about different ways too, but where cancer is concerned, by the toxic environment in which we live that spills into their diet, into their waterways, and gives them cancer, just as carcinogenic environments do to us.
Yeah, we found a study that took place in the St. Lawrence Estuary up in Canada, and they were looking at a range of animals, mainly beluga whales, that were coming up with all kinds of different cancers. It was ovarian and breast and gastrointestinal, and they were really wondering why this was going on, and eventually it was linked to some smelting plants that were on the shore and that they were also tracking with human cancers as well. So yes, shared environment and cancer is a really interesting area of study, and it's another place where increased collaboration between vets and human physicians could be really useful.
And that's called comparative oncology.
Mm-hmm.
So have there been any fruitful results so far from this kind of collaboration?
this is one of those areas that this idea of One Health, of bringing these two sides together, or Zubiquity, or comparative medicine, is really showing promise at the moment, this area of cancer research. So there's several studies around the country that are looking at various cancers, from osteosarcoma to melanoma, and showing promise for treatments and new ways of thinking about these cancers. In our book, we talk about one veterinarian named Philip Bergman, who worked with a human oncologist to find a treatment for melanoma. And he was in a group of Kettering, this Dr. Bergman, but he was the only veterinarian. They were all focusing on humans. And at one point, one of the doctors turned to him, the human doctors, and said, "Do dogs get melanoma?" And Bergman happens to be an expert on melanoma, and that's how their collaboration started. And what's important to know about their work and this kind of comparative oncology is that these are not, we're not talking about lab animals. These are people's beloved pets who often are participating in these new ideas and new tests for cures for cancer, because it's their pet's last hope. And it seems it's a good kind of combination of helping people's pets and also advancing the knowledge and investigation.
We're talking to Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers about their book Zubiquity. So there are some manifestations, behaviors, and so on in both animals and humans that one would think would not be adaptive. And your book is full of these. And one of them is fainting from fear, which lots of creatures do. Why do we do that? Why do animals and humans do that?
Yeah, right. So this is Barbara. One of the diseases, or not diseases, but disorders that you see a lot when you're a cardiologist is fainting. And there's a certain kind of fainting that happens when patients are either stressed or fearful, when there's an intense emotion. Some people faint, for example, when they have their blood drawn. Other people faint if they fracture a long bone or if they get terrible news. So there's this emotional component that can trigger a faint. And that particular kind of faint, it's called a vasovagal faint, involves a profound slowing of the heart rate. Now, you might wonder, well, why would that exist as a physiologic response to stress? You would think that there would just be a fight or flight response to fear or to pain, to some emotional activation. But it turns out our physiology, there are three options. In response to stress, we can either fight, flight, or we can faint. And animals, from other mammals to reptiles, even to fish, sometimes when they encounter danger and particularly predatory threat, they respond by slowing their hearts down profoundly. The reason it is believed that this occurs is that for an animal, for example, such as a fish, a very slowed heart rate leads to a quieting of the body and basically a kind of a hiding from a potential predator. And so it's believed that the profound slowing of the heart rate in response to predatory threat is actually an anti-predation response. And it has been so effective over hundreds of millions of years that it's preserved in our autonomic nervous systems. And so sometimes certain individuals will respond to intense stress, fear, emotion with a very slowed heart rate, which then leads to fainting. And it happens in some animals, contemporary animals as well, including some dogs and deer and rabbits and alligators. So it's seen across the animal kingdom, this response.
So basically, their predators will think they're dead or not good to eat?
Well, that's one possibility. The other is simply, a lot of predators hunt using acoustic signals. And so if an animal gets very, very quiet, if the rustling of the brushes stop, for an aquatic animal, the heart beat itself, the closing of the heart valves, the bump-a-dum, bump-a-dum, bump-a-dum that your doctor hears with the stethoscope, if that actually quiets down because of a profound slowing of the heart rate, that can actually lead to a predator not being able to lock in on the prey if they're hunting using the heartbeat.
Another thing that one thinks might not be adaptive is this thing that happens in both humans and all these different animals that you write about, which is in adolescence, there is a huge amount of risk-taking that people do or that creatures do. And here you have not fully grown animals taking life-threatening risks with their inexperience and their gangly legs and things like that. What's going on?
Well, this was a concept that was new and interesting to us, too, the idea that an animal might have a risky teenage period the way that human teens have a risk-taking teenage period. And what we realized after we compared animals and humans in that transition period from when they go from parental care to being on their own is that a certain amount of risk is actually necessary to help them become fully functioning adults. If they don't get experience defending themselves from predators, even knowing what their predators look like, smell like, act like, then they're, I guess, in essence, too sheltered and kind of can't defend themselves when they face them in real life. And the same thing kind of goes for their social upbringing, too. Animals, just like our own human teens, become more social and more drawn to their peers around that age, and it's for a similar function. They need to know about their peers in order to be, again, fully functioning mature adults.
And it seems that there are gender differences during this period, too, for a lot of animals.
Yeah, we had this wonderful opportunity to spend some time with a marine biologist who studies sea otters. And we were at a beachy area south of San Francisco, and the marine biologist was telling us that there's this region of water that is it's dangerous for the sea otters. There's not a lot of protective kelp, which means the sea otters can't hide anywhere, and they'd want to hide because trolling the waters are great white sharks and lots of them. So it turns out none of the adult sea otters will go into this area that the marine biologists call the triangle of death, right? None of the adults are going to go in there. And, of course, none of the babies are going to go either because they're with the grown-ups. None of the females go in there at all, but there is one group of sea otters that will go in and go in a lot, and those are actually the adolescent male sea otters, the sort of the daredevils of the sea otter world. And it's interesting because, of course, we know that among human teens, there is great risk associated with being a teenager, but especially if you're a male teenager. And that opens up the possibility that there's this conserved, this shared neurobiology that emerges during the transitional period from juvenile state to adult state that, you know, promotes this sensation-seeking and this interest in novelty. And all of that leads to the risk-taking, which sometimes in humans leads to injury and sadly death. And actually, in the case of the sea otters as well, it leads to much higher predation rates for these adolescent male sea otters.
And yet it leads to a greater rate of survival for the whole group, presumably.
Well, yeah. I mean, what's interesting, we talked to a primatologist who works with vervet monkeys, and we learned that among the vervet, the adolescent male vervets who left their natal group and went out to find their way, you know, in the larger world and enter another group, The males that were the most successful were the ones who would take risks, who were a little bit impulsive, who were more willing to really go for it, as she said. And those were the males that ultimately achieved higher status and higher success. But what was interesting was that period of impulsivity and risk-taking that they demonstrated during that transitional period when they were trying to enter a new group, it actually quieted down. So the best males, in a sense, were those who, during this transitional period, could be impulsive, could take risks, could go for it. But then, once they had matured somewhat, that those characteristics got dampened down a bit.
It's also true that a lot of these animals have mentors when they're in their adolescence. There's a kind of tragic situation about these endangered condors on the West Coast in California who were in a captive breeding program and they didn't have mentors and they didn't survive very well.
Mm-hmm. This was so interesting to me to realize that many, many animals have social groups. And I tended to think of social animals as being, you know, primates and maybe dogs and a few others. But there are social insects, there are social birds, there are social fish. And for those animals who have a very social living situation, they tend to have actually an extended adolescence. And that was the case for California condors. When they were severely endangered in the early 80s, their environmentalists said, let's let's do a captive breeding program and then slowly release them into the wild. And they modeled the program after a very successful program that they had used in the East for peregrine falcons. Falcons are not as social as condors, and so they were able to just release the young birds into the wild, and they kind of made it. These falcons just went off and did their thing. But when they tried to do that with the condors were, they didn't know what they were supposed to do. They ate garbage instead of food. They landed on power lines. They followed anything that would fly, really, a hang glider or a plane, thinking it was an older bird that they were supposed to be following in a kind of mentor situation. So that condor breeding program has come a really long way. It's incredibly successful at the moment. And what they've learned is that these birds, these social birds with long adolescences, need to be in a group environment as they're maturing so that they can learn from the more mature birds, learn from older birds, the behaviors that they're going to need to be successful later.
Very interesting. We're talking to Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers about their book, Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. Yet another thing that most of us probably thought was a human-only problem or situation is drug addiction. And it turns out that there are addictive substances that wild animals find in nature. Is this something that is related more to, for example, heroin-growing poppy field areas? Or is this really part of our natural history as creatures long before human beings started using addictive substances?
Right. Well, the answer is both. Certainly there are contemporary examples of substances that are being farmed. For example, in Tasmania, there are some of the world's largest poppy farms. Tasmania is one of the world's largest growers of medical-grade opium, and so of narcotics, basically, yeah, of opium. And the poppies, there's miles and miles and miles of poppies, which are surrounded with barbed wire fences. But some of the wallabies that live there will actually have learned to jump over the fences to access the poppy straw and the poppy sap. They get in there, they consume it, and they become intoxicated. They become high. And so that's an example of, an animal being interested in a farmed, sort of man-grown psychoactive substance. On the other hand, naturalists have been describing wild examples of psychoactive substance consumption for over 100 years. There are, for example, bighorn sheep that live in the Canadian Rockies that are very interested in a hallucinogenic lichen that grows at the top of these cliffs. And these bighorn sheep have been seen to scale very, very steep cliffs to access this lichen. There are also birds, for example, probably the most iconic example are the waxwing birds, both the Scandinavian waxwing and the North American waxwings, who are notorious for their preferential interest in fermented berries, the fermented berries of the pepper tree. And when these waxwings encounter these fermented berries, they consume them, they gorge on them, they become intoxicated. Veterinarians we spoke to described this erratic flying behavior that they call flying while intoxicated. And in a very sad parallel to the human case, these birds, when they're flying in the intoxicated state, will fly into walls, they'll fly into glass windows, and they actually can die of traumatic injuries, brain injuries, bone fractures, punctured viscus. So it's a very similar scenario.
And you're right that an animal isn't going to go to a liquor store or a pharmacist or their corner drug dealer, but those hallucinogenic or narcotic elements in the drugs that we take today are all derived from natural sources that animals do have access to in some places.
And of course, it's in the case that you just described of birds flying into buildings, it's the human-made buildings that are really the danger for them. They might do better if there were only trees around.
Oh, I guess that's true. I hadn't thought of it that way. Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
Is there a moderate, non-addictive, recreational use of drugs among animals?
It's a really great question, and one of the challenges when we were writing this was to be as sort of skeptical as possible. So one of the challenges, for example, with this chapter, Zooforia, as we called it, was to catalog the behavior, sort of be as journalistic as possible and find out where it's been seen and who saw it and really report it very accurately. But then the next question is, why are the animals doing it? Are they consuming the fermented berries, for example, because they're very high in calories? Is there some other benefit to the lichen that the bighorn sheep are interested in it? Yes, there's a psychoactive effect that's observed, but is that actually why the animals are seeking the substances? And the truth is, we really don't know the answer to that question. So it's then hard to know whether animals are using small amounts of this or that to achieve some, you know, mild psychoactive effect. I wouldn't rule it out, but I'd say at this point probably be hard to actually say that that were the case.
Yeah, I wondered that because, I mean, animals know, for example, when their stomachs aren't feeling well, what kind of plants to eat, and they'll go out and eat plants that they wouldn't eat otherwise. And so, who knows, they may have all sorts of instinctive knowledge about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question and one that we were very interested in pursuing. And, you know, there are lots of ways that question kind of has popped up as we've been doing research. One of the questions we had to do with, well, what an animal eats, whether an animal will ever eat beyond, for example, what's healthy for him. So one of the ideas that I had before we started this project was that animals would only eat until they were full, and that a wild animal would never overeat, that was a human problem. And, of course, it turns out that many, many wild animals, one expert we spoke to feels that pretty much any animal who's given access to abundance will overconsume and ultimately get fat. So although there may be these natural sort of health-promoting instincts that some animals have, there may be other instincts that are not that healthy, but that the environment kind of contains.
Well, just in the way that we will overconsume fat, sugar, and salt, because in nature, there was never an overabundance of it, but we're wired to eat those things because we need them and we need to store up on them out in the so-called state of nature. Then when we have fast food, we go crazy. Now, out in the real natural world, are there situations of overabundance of food where you see wild animals, not zoo animals, really getting fat?
Yeah, we came across several examples. One was the blue whales off the coast of California. We talked to the captain of a whale-watching ship who has been out there for 30 years watching these whales, and he said some years they're so thin you can see the individual vertebrae on their backs as they're coming to the surface, and other years they're just, depending on the krill situation in the Pacific, they are fat and well-padded. And we heard about some fish in a lake in... where was that lake?
Slovakia.
In Slovakia, that actually the people there thought that they were two different species because there was the thin version and the bigger version, and it depended on how many nutrients they were eating in the lake. We've also heard of dolphins, and there's actually been an increase in the body mass of marmots in the Rockies that's happened over the last several decades that's paralleled the human obesity rise in obesity also. So yes, given a chance, animals will overconsume, and it's sometimes reflected in their bodies. The big difference is that in nature, usually there's an end point. Either the season shifts or the abundance runs out or a predator moves into the area, so an animal has to be more vigilant and stops eating. There's some sort of cyclical end point, which we modern humans have engineered out of the process.
So those fluctuations in weight for animals are actually, that works for them. I mean, it's adaptive for them to sometimes be fat and then to lose the weight.
That was interesting, too, was just to find out that ask almost any veterinarian about an animal's weight or their body mass or what they actually call body condition, and what they want to see is a range. They don't want to see an animal being the exact same weight every single day of its life. They know that depending on what that animal is doing, its body is going to be reflecting its needs. So if an animal is getting pregnant or it's lactating or it's migrating or it's molting or any other thing that an animal has to do in its yearly life, its weight is going to reflect that, and it needs a variable weight as an indicator of health.
Let's go back for a moment to the question of drug addiction. How does understanding this animal drug use and animal addiction help us understand people?
Right. Well, one of the ways of thinking about, you know, why animals, you know, might use these substances or find them pleasurable, let's say, is to remember that at least among mammals, we have a very conserved nervous system. We share a tremendous amount with the nervous system, for example, of a rodent, right? Our brains have evolved. The mammalian brain has evolved to probably reward with pleasure activities that are fitness promoting. So we're talking about activities that promote, you know, reproduction and activities that promote survival. So if you think about it, you think about eating, you think about sex, you think about social comfort and socializing, those are pleasure-enhancing activities. Our brains are rewarded for engaging those activities. And the same thing is likely true with animals as well. That circuitry can get hijacked by substances. We see that, of course, among human beings all the time, whether it's cocaine or alcohol or other drugs. Those exogenous substances that people use hijack those circuits and give the individual the sensation that they have engaged in these fitness-promoting behaviors, even though they haven't. And so it may be that when we see the animals doing the same thing, that they, too, are, you know, experiencing that sensation of fitness enhancement that we do as well.
And we just think that seeing some similar behavior in non-human animals can be really destigmatizing for somebody who's going through addiction themselves or helping somebody else who is.
We're talking to Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers about the book Zubiquity. Another thing that I think would probably be very helpful to a lot of teenagers and perhaps adults too who engage in this behavior that we call cutting, where they cut their own skin, is the chapter that you have on animals that harm themselves. There are birds that pick their own feathers until it hurts. What's going on with that? And again, is that found in the wild?
This was something else you mentioned earlier, that that there's some behaviors that don't really seem all that adaptive. This was something that really surprised us. We came at it with the same thing. Do animals self-injure? Would an animal ever self-harm? And it seems like, why would they? Because how are they going to get their genes into the next generation if they're harming themselves? But when we looked more closely at it, we realized that, yes, there are many animals, particularly when they are when there are certain triggers that veterinarians know well, they will bite or poke or scratch themselves. And the triggers that veterinarians know are stress, isolation, and boredom. So, for example, there's something called flank biting in horses. It's particularly in stallions. They seem to do it more than the female horses do. But the stallion will turn around and bite its own flank and then continue biting until it bleeds. And one way that veterinarians have found to treat this is to return that animal to a more natural grouping, to its herd. So whenever possible, they'll put that animal back with another group of horses, which is the environment it evolved to live in. And if that's not possible, they'll try another kind of companion, either a chicken or sometimes a goat, and sometimes the presence of that other animal will help with those self-harming behaviors.
So that's an example of an animal in a domesticated situation doing these kinds of behaviors. Did you see anything like that out in the jungle, for example?
Well, it's interesting. When we began looking into self-injury, we did hear a lot of experts tell us that it was seen primarily in domestic or captive environments. But we ultimately spoke to a couple of people who told us that they had seen a kind of self-soothing behavior among certain monkeys, tail sucking, for example. So tail sucking can be soothing. And by the way, to take a step back, it's interesting to think about self-injury in animals as an attempt by the animal to soothe themselves through a kind of grooming behavior. So cats, dogs, I mean, all of us have seen animals lick themselves and groom themselves to sort of relieve stress and to sort of reestablish a calmness. But some veterinarians think that self-injury in animals, particularly the kind where they're licking and licking and licking or biting and biting until they bleed, is really a dialing up of that self-soothing grooming instinct. And so that is seen in the wild as well, that use of grooming to soothe. And some experts tell us that they have seen some monkeys, for example, sucking their tails more, and that may be an indication that under stressful circumstances in the wild, that response may exist as well.
Have you seen people who engage in self-harming or self-mutilating behavior come in contact with this Zubiquity work and witness other animals doing it, and does that affect them?
I love that question. this was really a surprise to us when we encountered it. I remember, this is Barbara, I remember the day we were in the midst of doing our research, and you know, we were looking at the overlap in the cancers of animals and humans and heart disease and infectious diseases. And then I had a woman come to my clinic, my cardiology clinic, and she had a complaint of palpitations. But when I was listening to her chest, I noticed that on her arm she had scars, and she told me that she was a cutter. And Catherine and I began asking, well, do animals self-injure? And, of course, it turned out the answer was yes. But the point is that the use of self-injury in species from parrots who pluck out their feathers to, you know, dogs that lick themselves, that it's common, and human patients, when they learn about this, find it normalizing, find it destigmatizing. We got a wonderful note from a woman who read the book in the first month it was published, and she told us that she had started self-injuring when she was a teenager, and it was under very stressful life circumstances. She was isolated, and she thought she had invented this behavior. And later on, she'd become involved with animals, and she'd seen similar behavior. But for her, learning that animals, isolated animals, self-injured just as she had started to self-injure was reassuring and normalizing for her.
And meanwhile, ladies and gentlemen, it turns out that animals, along with everything else, get and spread sexually transmitted diseases, including the cute little koala bears.
Well, when you think about it, animals are having sex usually with multiple partners, and they're not using condoms. They're not practicing safe sex. So when you think about it, why wouldn't they be passing around STDs? And indeed they do. Yes, we were. I personally was surprised at the extent of the activity and the spread.
And they can't really have any awareness of that.
No, I wouldn't think that there's awareness. What it points to is that this is a something that we've all evolved with over thousands and millions of years, this battle between the pathogens and the viruses and the fungi in our world and our health. And
yeah, and actually there are some ornithologists who have observed something called cloacal inspection. So there are birds who will actually inspect the cloaca of their partners before they mate with them. And so there's been some speculation that, they're not consciously saying, oh, I'm looking for evidence of a bird STD, but it's conceivable that they're doing a general health assessment before they mate with that animal. So, yes, cloacal inspection occurs in birds.
There's also a great interest now in among biologists and in the medical field about how pathogens influence our behavior. And so we got into it a little bit in our chapter, which we called The Koala and the Clap, about what it might mean to a human physician studying a human STD, which we know are very deadly around the world, to think about how that virus might affect the behavior of its animal host and whether there's anything there for the human side to learn from.
All of this that we're talking about, or much of it, leads to the larger question of animal emotions. And from the perspective of a layperson and a dog owner, which I am, I mean, animals clearly have emotional lives. What's the scientific perspective on that now, and how far have we come? I mean, it seems like even when I was a kid, nobody even considered the idea that dogs had emotions.
Yeah, I would say we've come far, even in just the past decade. Much greater acceptance of animal emotion, animal cognition is a booming area of study, especially among dogs at the moment. Barbara, when you were going through medical school, wasn't there a whole different perspective even on how animals feel pain?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting to learn that up until really the mid-1980s, there were there was a belief that, you know, animals might not really feel pain, and consequently, in some cases, not all, but in some cases, surgeries were actually done without anesthesia. There was physical restraint, but in some cases, there was a belief that, well, the animal is you know, bucking, and you need to restrain them so you can do the procedure, but that they weren't experiencing pain the way, you know, a human might. In a really remarkable and tragic corollary on the human side, even when I was in medical school, we were told that neonates had a very immature nervous system and that they couldn't feel pain very much the way older children could. So, I mean, we've learned a lot since then. But when I was going to college and then medical school, I remember being very, very sternly warned about anthropomorphizing. That was, you know, considered, you know, intellectually, you know, very, very, very poor behavior. I mean, so if I saw anything that looked humanoid in an animal, I certainly would have been hesitant to say anything about that. Well, since I went to medical school, there's been a tremendous amount of, it's just an explosion of knowledge about neuroimaging and neuroanatomy and physiology. And so now I think people are much more willing to acknowledge that animals, certainly our companion animals, have emotional lives, and that they also can have disturbed behavior, a mental illness, just as we can. And we did really want to explore that a lot in the book.
And even just the idea that a flock of birds or a herd of elk, that it's not a flock or a herd of clones. Within that group, there are going to be animals that are bolder or shyer. There's going to be animals that have just eaten and feel sated, and others that are still hungry. They're going to have very different personalities and minute-by-minute behaviors within that group. And I think that's also really interesting to keep in mind.
I think it is, too. And I think it's important for us to learn not to group people as being all the same. And we tend to do that. You know, we say Italians are like this or some other group is like that. And for example, as I'm the owner of two Jack Russell Terriers, which are very different in personality and like to eat different things, and one eats slowly and the other eats quickly, and one had a kind of an eating disorder, which is more or less in check now, and the other one didn't, and they're the same breed. And so, I mean, actually, let's talk for a moment about eating disorders. That's something that you also have observed in the wild.
Yeah, tell us about your Jack Russell. What was the eating disorder?
Well, she had not gotten, the people who owned her before I did had three big dogs and her, and they fed them all out of one bowl, so she never got enough to eat. So she came over to my house, adopted me, stole the poodle's food, because I was living with a poodle at that time, and basically thought this is the place where she would eat until she died if she had an infinite amount of food. She's kind of moderated since then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when we were asking ourselves, do animals get eating disorders, our first thought was, no way. I mean, that's so human. It's driven by media images and our desire to be thin and body image issues, and, you know, no animal's going to have that. But what we realized is that if you ask a different question, if you ask, does stress alter animal eating, then the answer is, yeah, actually.
It alters eating in both directions, just as it does in humans. So, for example, we know that there are some, as you say, some dogs, for example, who will consume and consume and consume. Other animals, other dogs, in response to stress, will not eat. I have two dogs, and I remember one of our dogs had to go away for surgery, and during that period of time, the dog who stayed at the house with us would barely eat at all. I think a lot of people have had that experience. So, you know, eating is affected by what's happening in an animal's environment, a non-human animal, a human animal. We did look, though, for correlates of human kind of classic eating disorders. We learned that there are animals who self-induce vomiting. There are cats who have something called feline bulimia. There are vultures who will regurgitate. It's called defensive regurgitation, and they do that in response to predatory threat. And we learned that there are marine mammals, such as beluga whales and dolphins, and some great apes, including gorillas and chimpanzees, who will regurgitate in response to social stress. actually they do something called regurgitation and reingestion, where they reconsume what they vomited. But, you know, veterinarians know that this behavior, this R&R, regurgitation and reingestion, seems to be a response to social stress. And that's very intriguing to think about in the context of bulimia nervosa in human beings.
We're talking about the book Zubiquity, and in this work, there is not only an amazing new set of research possibilities, but it also seems like this is a paradigm shift away from the idea that human beings are separate from and perhaps higher than the rest of nature, to more of a kind of one world view, one big nature of which we are a part, which seems like it's both a step forward in science, but also it's more in line with a lot of indigenous worldviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is this kind of, it's surprising in a way that this is a quote-unquote new idea, because it really is one of the oldest ideas in the world. I mean, we humans exist on a continuum of animal life. We don't, you know, sit on one side of a species divide. But even though we acknowledge that we are animals, there's this sort of ambivalent acceptance of that fact. And you know, I have had this opportunity to, you know, I work in the human medical world in a wonderful tertiary medical center at UCLA, but I've had this opportunity to spend a lot of time in the world of veterinary medicine. And the two fields are very much the same, and yet culturally they're very divided. And I think that division really reflects some of our human ambivalence about embracing our animal natures.
I have to say since I've gotten dogs and had them in the veterinary hospital from time to time, I've always wished that I could be treated at Smith Veterinary Hospital, because the veterinarians are so cooperative and kind and also very scientific, sometimes more than doctors, in the way they treat animals.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We've heard a lot of people tell us that they wish that their physicians could be more like their veterinarians. Yeah. And, you know, of course, everybody probably means something a little bit different, but I think in general there is a quality that we encountered in many of the veterinarians we met and interviewed and worked with. There is a holistic approach, as I mentioned before, a kind of a tendency to look at the overall environment in which their patient is living, the ecology, the other animals with whom the patient is living, and to sort of take those factors into consideration when thinking about whatever the problem is. It's interesting. There's all of these sort of little jokes that go back and forth between physicians and veterinarians. But, you know, unfortunately, for decades, veterinarians have had to endure some condescension from physicians who don't always consider vets to be their clinical peers. But on the other hand, veterinarians have a little barb, a little, you know, joke at the expense of physicians that they like to tell. They ask the question, what do you call a veterinarian who can only take care of one species?
Right.
And of course, you know, that would be a physician.
That's right. Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers are co-authors of the book Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. They will be in Santa Fe tonight giving a lecture titled Zubiquity, What Dolphin Diabetes Can Teach Us About Human Health. It's at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.